Thank you, Michael. And now I would like to introduce our main speaker, Kristen Jay, from San Diego.
Oh, hey. Hi, my name is Kirsten. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kirsten.
I might get a little loud, so just let me know if I should back up or move forward. My sobriety date... My sobriety date is September 29th, 2009, so I recently celebrated 8 years of sobriety. It's crazy, right? And when I first got here, I judged the relapsers, and I thought I was somewhat spiritually superior because that wasn't my story. Like, something, I figured something out. And that's delusion. That's the delusion that I have. I'm in the delusion that I didn't try to quit over and over and over again, and I failed. I spent 10 years on my own before I got to AA trying not to drink, and I wasn't able to. So relapse isn't my story after I came to these rooms, but for sure, I tried for a decade to not drink. I was just a little nut. I'm still a little nuts. So if you're new, welcome. If you're new and you didn't identify as new, welcome. I didn't want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was a bunch of, I had an idea in my head and I didn't fit into that. Even though I had a friend who got sober, she was really bad, you know? Yeah, it's really good to be here tonight. I haven't been to a big meeting in a really long time. I was just living for the past 3 years on an island in Indonesia, so our meetings were really small. And the book talks about we can go anywhere and do anything given that we practice certain principles, which is these principles, the 12 steps. And so I didn't have to drink. I was able to travel around and meet other people and do the steps, and I have sponsees in all different countries. And, you know, it's kind of cool to talk about, okay, so Akron, that's America, and that's, you know, in Ohio, to people who are Australian and stuff. But this stuff works. It's universal. I even know a little bit of Indonesian. I even got to bring the message into jail and speak my very broken Indonesian to a group of men in prison, which was quite the experience, too. So I was never going to drink, so I started controlling drinking before I even started because I grew up in an alcoholic home, and then I finally drank when I was 16, and I had a beer and a half, and this is what I thought. I love the way I feel so much. I better control this. I don't want to ever have to give it up. Let's not overdo it. So I'm trying to control it before, right at the beginning, and then the rest of my drinking was just like that, trying to control it, because I love the way alcohol feels so much. You know, that's why I'm here, because I love it, because I wasn't feeling good inside, and alcohol absolutely saved my life. Like, when it talks about the promises in the big book, my fear of people and insecurities went away. Like, all of a sudden, I got everything that I wanted as soon as I drank, which was friends and to be popular, to be cool, to be liked, to, like, ask people out, to go out and hang out with people and socialize. All that fear went away, and I went from, you know, people get voted, like, most likely to be president in the high school yearbook. I got voted, I mean, I was one person the first 2 years of high school, and I was somebody else the second 2 years. I got voted most changed since freshman year, you know? And thank God, because that summer between sophomore and junior year, like, I mean, I remember thinking I would never have kids because it would be cruel to bring somebody into the world because of the amount of emotional pain that I am in. I would never do this to somebody. That's fucked up to, like, bring somebody into this. And my experience is that, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic home, so there was a lot of chaos growing up. My mom's boyfriend was sexually inappropriate with me for years. So I was dealing with that, and then I ran away from home a couple of times because I didn't want to be around. I didn't want to be sexually abused anymore. But then I ran to my dad's house, and he was drunk and full of rage. So it was nowhere safe, no matter where I went. And I did the best that I could to take care of myself. But as soon as I drank, it was like all those feelings, like the fear, the rage, the anger, the shame, like all of it went away, and I was like, wow, I'm gonna keep doing this. And then I went to raves. That was really fun. There was a lot of, I'm 41, so in the 90s, I was, like, you know, in the club for a long time in the warehouse in San Francisco. There was a lot of fun music and there was a lot of alcohol and pill form there that I also enjoyed. I also always looked younger than I was. So I couldn't get alcohol before I was 21, really. So that helped me not have to feel my feelings for a while until I could go into bars. And, you know, people say it's fun, fun with problems, and then problems. That's my experience. Like, in the beginning, it was really good. Like, I had a really good time. And then things started happening, you know, but I did what I knew how to do, which is acting like it didn't happen, right? Like, if I didn't remember, it didn't count was one of my rules. That totally makes sense. But also, when I didn't know how to handle a situation like a trauma, I also acted like it didn't happen. And I thought that I could sweep it under the rug. I didn't realize that the rug was actually, like, that I had a drink to keep that rug down, that there was this bubbling thing like beneath the surface. So I went through a lot of re-victimization, which a lot of people who have childhood sexual abuse do. I got re-victimized over and over and over again, and I could not connect the dots until way into my sobriety. I did not know that I got raped when I was 18 years old until I was 33 years old doing the steps with my sponsor. And I told her what happened in my dorm room, and she said, "So he raped you." I was like, whoa. Yeah, I was crying and I said no the entire time. That's what that would mean. I could not let myself think that at the time. And for anybody who's been abused as a kid will get what I'm saying. I could not let myself look at the truth as the truth because I had no ability to cope with it. In fact, I kept hanging out with that man for years. And this is a man that before that happened held a loaded gun to my head. You know, it was my friend, right? These are my friends. I don't know what safe is. So I don't know not only how to recognize when it's unsafe, I don't know how to protect, like, get into a safe situation. You know, like, my roommates have drugs, and they're drug dealers, and there's guns everywhere. Because dad was drunk, mom's boyfriend was a pervert. I don't know what it feels like to not be freaked out when I go to sleep. You know, but then I did, because then alcohol would make me go to sleep, and I'd be okay. Alcohol took it all away, and then I had this other... I love entrepreneurs. You know, all my boyfriends have always been entrepreneurs. Before I got sober, that looked like they were drug dealers. Making it happen. And so there's a lot that goes along with that. Like, I remember one time I had this rule, and like, so I can put a boundary down, but how do I hold the boundary down? I've been gaslit my whole life. How do I, like, I've been told my reality isn't right. And then I'll drink so that I can try to go along with your reality. So I'm betraying myself, until I get sober. But I had this one boyfriend that, I don't want to be drunk for too long, so I got to be mindful of the time. Our deal was that if we were going to move into this new house together, we'd been going out for a while, we'd already lived together, that you can only have up to, like, 1 pound of pot in the house at a time, and no guns. I think that was, like, my deal, right? My best thinking. And... the problem was there was just this thing that was too good to pass up for him 1 week into living there, and he didn't tell me about it. And we got robbed. We were home, and they stole everything. And then he needed to do this stuff to pay it back. So next thing I know, I go into the laundry room, and there's this machine that's like this big, and it's spin. There's like a light with marijuana growing around it. And I'm like, what? I don't even know what I'm looking at. And I just close it. And so I do what I know how to do, is I drank. You know, he would have it all in the trunk, and he'd drive like a maniac, and I didn't know how to cope with having all these drugs in the trunk when he's driving like crazy. And so I'd bring wine with me when we drive. I didn't know to break up with him. Like, I didn't know you leave crazy situations. I just didn't know. I was like, make it work. Shut your feelings down. It's okay. This is love. And then, you know, it kept getting worse. And so I kept drinking more. The consequences were adding up. I didn't know how to handle any of it. I didn't even know a lot of it was a problem. And it spiraled. And guess what? I had all these anxiety disorders. Where would that come from, right? I keep drinking over this trauma, acting like it didn't happen. And then I'm telling the psychiatrist, I got in a car accident. Now I have panic attacks. And he's like, how much do you drink? It's not why I'm here, and I don't want your advice on alcohol. I drink two drinks twice a week. So 4 drinks total a week, about. And so so he prescribed me benzos, which I took as prescribed, 2 a day for the next 3.5 years. I learned in sobriety that that's actually drug abuse because he prescribed them for somebody else because I lied to him about what my conditions were. So because I lied about my drinking, I actually wrote him a letter of amends saying, I'm sorry you weren't able to help me because I wasn't honest with you. I went to rehab and I'm sober now. But you know what? Like, he was a bit of a drug dealer. Like, his solution to, I mean, he really was. I was agoraphobic at the end, which is afraid to leave the house. And so and that's why I'd call him up panicking and not see him. He'd still write it off to the insurance. He wanted his money, you know? And so I'm not blaming him. What I'm saying is I wasn't ready to get well. So I found somebody to keep me sick. When I was ready to get well, that's not who I was attracted to. And that's not what I did. And so his solution to my breakup was to hook me up with another one of his patients. We went on a blind date, another one of the psych guys for one of his clients. So I was sick and I was around sick people. He also gave me a book about how to control your drinking. And it was like, drink water, you know, drink one and then drink water. And then, you know, the next one, like hours away. And I'm like, stupid. I didn't want to drink one. And I had another friend saying, I was like, you know, the bartender makes the drink so strong. It's not my fault. I blacked out and did this and whatever. And I mean, I'd wake up from blackouts like single, you know, and I'd be like, where's my boyfriend? And his roommate would be like, well, after he dumped you, he split. I'm like, bah, again? Like, so it was really confusing. And so the anxiety kept getting worse because I wasn't being honest. I didn't tell anybody I was seeing a psychiatrist. I had too much shame. I didn't tell anybody I was on meds. I had too much shame. I didn't tell anybody how much I was drinking. I had too much shame. I didn't know there was a way out. But what I did know for sure, it was kept getting worse. It kept getting worse. And I didn't think that there was a way out. And I thought the downward spiral only went down. And eventually I got fired from my job. Again, you know, there was another trauma there. Like, I went on a work trip, and I got raped on a work trip. And my boss told all the executives, so instead of leaving my company, because that was really uncomfortable to have everyone at my people at my work, all the higher-ups, knowing about what happened to me, I'd be giving presentations and having panic attacks, looking around at the room, not knowing who was thinking about the worst thing in my life. And so I'd run out of the meeting. I got to go to the bathroom. I'd run, nibble on a Xanax, and come back. What I know now is that, what is it, the alcoholic, we're the only ones who change our goals to meet our behaviors, where other people change their behaviors to meet their goals. So it was like I fell in a ditch and I decorated it. It was real sparkly in there. What I would do now, if God forbid that happened, I would get another job. I would dump the boyfriend. I would move out of the roommate who's putting guns to my head. I would stop hanging out with a person who raped me. You know, like, that's what I would do now, because now I have a sober mind frame, but I just didn't know. So everything, and there's so many more things, I won't bore you on that, but you get the point. I mean, maybe there's somebody here tonight who relates to that, who is like, I could not even see how bad it was until I was years into sobriety. I could not see, because I could not let myself see. It was too much for me to handle. Like, they talk about the layers of the onion. We heal a different, you know, there's the lower hanging fruit, right? I had like a 2-year anxiety attack when I was sober. I didn't know how to be alive and like not panic. Like without alcohol, without the meds, I was just like in meetings. If they asked me to read something the entire time, I was just like shaking, like I can't do this. So I needed to learn how to like get cool with the anxiety and get over my anxiety attacks, which I did. The brain is miraculous and can totally get rewired. Mindfulness and meditation, part of my step 11. It was great for that. I had a teacher who taught me about, you know, some outside books that were really helpful, spiritual teachers, and she taught me how to meditate. 2 minutes was crazy. Like my rule was, I have such bad ADHD all of a sudden. You guys, like I have a graduate degree like in math, and like I got sober and I was like, could not even connect 2 brain cells. It was like, this one speaks French and this one speaks Greek. And I'm like, what? So I would sit there. I'm like, I think I used to be smart. Like, well, how come I can't like, it's like firing. And then I'm like filling in like, because I blacked out so much. I would be like, have a short circuit and be like, oh, what am I going to tell them? I got to make something up. And I'm like, oh, wait, I'm just walking down the street to a meeting. I'm 6 months sober. I don't black out anymore. Like, my brain, I'm like realizing that my brain is trying to make me right and them wrong through a blackout that I didn't have. What is going on up here?
Can you say that last statement again?
I was really crazy. My brain, the wiring in my brain. Totally. I didn't even understand how bad it was. And you know what is so amazing? Like, when I got here, thank God I got here, I went to rehab, and it was a non-12-step rehab without God because I wasn't an alcoholic, and there is no God, so why would I go to AA? And in rehab, though, they had to say your name and alcoholic. They'd be like, Bob, alcoholic, Frank, alcoholic. And I'd be like, Kirsten, anxiety. You realize this is a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. Yep. Just don't want to become one. Just here for my anxiety. I was in such arrogant denial that I actually didn't drink the morning I went to rehab, which was unusual for me because I drank in the morning at the very end. I'd be waking up at 7 a.m., 7 p.m., not knowing if it was day or night, not knowing if the night's coming or going. Either way, I'd drink if I had alcohol. If I didn't have alcohol, it'd take me about 2 hours to leave the house. To get the emotional strength together to cross the street, it was I got sober September 29th, so I'd put on, so this is September, which is really warm, and I'd put on a parka, sunglasses over my pajama pants and scuffle across my street in San Francisco to go to the liquor store, or I'd go up the block to the other liquor store. Because God forbid this one knows how much I drink, right? So I get to rehab, sober AF, right? I'm not going to drink this morning. She's like, how much do you have to drink? I'm like, nothing. I'm here for anxiety. And then she's like, how did you get that black eye? She hands me a mirror. That was my moment of clarity. I'm like, I don't even know what my face looks like. And I have no idea how I got this. And I just flew to LA from San Francisco. I've just been on a plane, like flying with. I had stopped looking in mirrors because the last time I looked in a mirror was a week earlier, and what I saw was an empty shell, like a soulless human being who was about to die, and it was terrifying. It was so, and I knew I was dying from alcohol, and I was so scared that I stopped looking in mirrors. Right? Drinking? No, we keep doing that. No mirrors. I'll give up mirrors. So yeah, I saw that black eye in rehab, and that was my surrender moment. I was like, all right, I need to listen to these people because I have no clue what's happening. And I did. And then there was an optional AA meeting to go to once a week in rehab. Nobody went because everyone there thought AA was a joke, and that's why we found the one and only non-AA rehab in the world, probably. It's in Malibu. And except it was fancy, and there was this celebrity there, and he was being filmed for the show Intervention, and I thought he was really cool. I knew who he was, like, you know, before rehab. I'd seen him on MTV, and I liked his music, and he was all about AA. So, you know, Mr. Hip Hop was going to the AA meeting by himself in the druggy buggy, and I was like, well, I want what he has, so if he's going to go, I'll go. You know, Pride, right? Pride. So I got in the van and I went to the AA meeting because of him. It was one of the big meetings like this where everyone goes around and says their name, and they started with me because I said it was my first meeting, and they wouldn't continue the meeting until I said alcoholic. I was so angry that you guys got me to lie. I mean, I was like having a panic attack, like, oh my God, stop looking at me, everybody, like 300 people. Alcoholic! Bah! You know, one of those newcomers who says alcoholic, like where we like stumble, we can't even say the word. It's like terrifying. so pissed. The night I got out of rehab, it was a sick joke. It was called the dry dock, the marina dry dock, right? And where I know this woman from. And it was the marina dry dock, and I'm thinking, I like boats. What does this mean? You know, and I go down to the dry dock right out of rehab, like a couple hours off the plane. And it's kitty corner to the bar that I went to every Thursday night. My friends are in the bar, I could see them. There's this cult over here of God-loving alcoholics. And I'm like, that's my best friend. It looks warm, the lights. So they have my Riesling on the counter. I was like, you know what? Rehab was really expensive. I have to go in this door tonight. I can drink tomorrow. Thank God. I needed to be out that money, you know, to walk in the door of AA that night. And I went in the door, and someone gave me their seat. It was totally crowded. There was a lot of kindness, and people were nice. And someone said, I'm your temporary sponsor, and I got handed a book. And I was like, this is like that my religious best friend in grade school who just started giving me her Bible. So I'm like, you know, like, I'm like, I don't know what this is. Like, this just feels like your beliefs. I don't want this. You know, you guys were really nice. And I hadn't been honest in a long time. And the kindness brought me back the next day. And she wanted to read the book at a cafe, and I was like, I kind of want to drink with you. I don't want to read the book with you. You know, I'm like, you guys would be fun drinking friends. And I kept going, and then I went to my temporary sponsor's house. And she, I was bummed. I didn't want to be there. It was a Sunday night, and she starts reading the big book to me, and she's reading, like, the forward to the fourth edition to this or that, and then 100 of us, you know, and I'm like, what is this, Eve? This is weird. And then there was an answer. She had a phone call, and her answering machine went off, which was also weird. She had an answering machine, you know, like a physical one. And, I mean, it was 2009, but still, I was like, the book's weird. The answering machine's weird. And it said on the answering machine, hey, Amber, happy birthday. You know, I really want to get a hold of you today and wish you birthday, you know, happy birthday and all this stuff. And I was just like, wow, this woman is spending her birthday reading this book with me. There's something here that I needed to hear that, you know, that what she wants to do on her birthday, which at that time for me, you know, I hadn't had a sober birthday yet. I was, you know, lots of people drunk. We'd all get on a cable car with a big thing of rum or whatever. Right? That was what I thought of a birthday. And she's spending her birthday with me reading this book. I was like, okay. So slowly my experience is, you know, I came to believe very slowly. I was very resistant to the God thing. I was very resistant to AA. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. Sometimes I'd said it with social pressure. I'd say it in a meeting. But really, it wasn't until I was 90 days sober that I realized that I conceded to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. It took me that well until I heard a man, he was like 50 years older than me, very different sexual orientation, very different, you know, ethnicity, the opposite of me in every outside way you could possibly imagine. Everything was the opposite. And he had my story. He told my story. And I was just like, wow, if that's what this is, I'm one of these things, you know. And then I learned later in here, that that what makes me an alcoholic, it isn't what happens to me. Because I'd be like, well, I haven't had a DUI, or I'm not that bad, or but my friend loses her shoes every time, you know. So what makes me an alcoholic is that if even once, and it was many times, when I put alcohol in my system, I lose the ability to control how much goes in, like what Michelle was calling it, the physical allergy, where I break out in a craving, and I go out for two drinks. And sometimes I can go out for two drinks. I can control my drinking, but I can't enjoy it. Sometimes I go out for two drinks, and I try to control it, and then I think that I choose to say, F it. And the next thing I know, it's 1:45 a.m. I'm at Safeway, because at 2 o'clock, they stop selling alcohol. You hard stop. You have to get that swiped across the conveyor belt, but, you know, don't F around with that. Get the bottle, go to the friend's house, and then it's like 3 days later. You know, like, I didn't have control over alcohol. And so I learned that it's not what happens when I drink outside that makes me an alcoholic. It's what happens inside that makes me an alcoholic. I could drink once every 3 years and still be an alcoholic because it's what happens to me when I drink, not what the drinking necessarily looks like, although it doesn't look pretty. I hang out with some weird people. I'm a weird person, too, when I'm drunk. Maybe when I'm sober. More will be revealed. So slowly, and I lied in the beginning. You know, I didn't do it perfectly. I didn't drink. I haven't had a drink since rehab or coming to AA. But my sponsor said, pray every day. And I'd be like, yep. She doesn't know what's happening in my head. That's easy. Check. Yep, did that. And I just lied about praying because I thought the idea of a higher power is as silly as the idea of the tooth fairy keeping me sober. And I didn't see the point in it. My background is math, right? Statistics. So I needed data and proof. My whole life was about data and proof and analytics and like hard facts and like analyzing data, logical thinking. But then the time and the place came when I was 8 months sober, where the only thing between me and a drink was a prayer, just like the book said. My experience is for a good year or longer, I thought that this book, that you guys were trying to control me through this book, and I was real resistant to this book. It took me a while to realize you guys were trying to save my life, and this is the recipe. And, you know, when I lived in Bali, I actually worked at the rehab there for the last 6 months that I lived on the island. And it was so funny for me to be with all these newcomers, the people at the rehab, who think that I'm trying to F with them. And I'm like, I'm the help, and I'm just like you. I know you're lying to me. And then I remember when I was in rehab, what I thought of the help and how I did. I'm like, oh. So the time and the place came where the only thing that was going to keep me sober was God. I call my higher power God. It's just easier that way. I was in a bathroom in Sydney, Australia. I was with people who I used to drink with who were alcoholics, who made a bet on when I was going to drink. They said it's going to be on this trip for sure. They spiked my drink with vodka. I smelled it when I put it to my face. I did not drink it. I hid it behind a plant, got a soda water, so they thought I was drinking. They had this rum punch bowl, kept putting it into my face with all these straws, you know, one of those big ones. And he was so annoying. I almost took a drink just to stop him, like not realizing, getting caught off guard. And then I was scared because I actually really wanted to drink. And I'm just like, I am screwed. I'm a total victim of these assholes. I'm trying not to swear. And then I went to the bathroom and I prayed. I prayed to a God I didn't believe in. Please help me not drink tonight. Please help me keep sober. Please. Oh, please help me get out of here without drinking. I really want to drink. Please help me not drink tonight. And I didn't have to drink that night. And I was willing from that moment forward to pray. And I prayed most days. I want to say every day, but I don't know for sure that that's true. I said the third step. I started saying the third step prayer after that every night before bed when I lay in bed for years. And it really took me to be that desperate to reach for God. You know. And what I realized through the help of my sponsor is I was not a victim of these drinkers trying to get me drunk. I was in the process of a relapse, and I was delusional. I was choosing to be with alcoholics. I was choosing to be in a bar. I was choosing to not know anybody in recovery, to not know where any meetings are. I was choosing to hang out with, you know, I was taking, if relapse is a 20-step process, I had taken 19 steps and was blaming all you for it, and I was about to get drunk. But I couldn't see it. You know, because I can't see when my boat goes 1 degree off the shore of sobriety. It's only when I'm really far off the shore of sobriety that maybe, well, it's happened to me several times in sobriety, that I get woken up before I end up in a relapse. Somebody said in a meeting once that alcoholism is like being on the top of a canoe, on top of a waterfall in a canoe, and the waterfall's behind you. It's inevitable. Like, destruction is behind you. That's the way, that's nature's way. You're going this way. And the oars are the steps. And I need to do the work in order to not go over into the disaster that's right behind me. And if I ease up and rest the oars on my laurels, I am going backwards and going downhill into disaster. And over and over and over again, I have met people in these rooms that's been their story. I don't know what happened. I just stopped going to meetings. I stopped praying. I thought the God thing was weird. And then they're drunk, you know? I want to read my favorite part in the book just because it's just a trip, you know, for the people, especially the people in here who are really resistant to the word alcoholic, to being identified as an alcoholic, or even the word God. Like, I totally get that. That's me, was me. But page 51 in We Agnostics, which is my favorite chapter, when many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. God is the most important thing in my life today. Never thought I'd say that. Like, I used to like make fun of like the people, the old timers who would like say the same one liner every meeting, you know, I'm Bob and this is my one liner and then I'm going to share. And I'd be like, oh God. And then I started having a one liner and I'm like, oh God. And I'm doing the quotes one day at a time, you know. But sometimes I need to remember that thing one day at a time. Like, I need to bring my head back into the moment because I can go over here too. You know, like it's a spiritual, it's a practice. I don't go to yoga once and then I'm super fit, right? I don't do this once and then I'm good. It's a practice. I need to do it on a regular basis to stay spiritually fit and connect, have access to the higher power. I have not had access in sobriety, and it's really scary. So, what was I going to say? Strange mental blank spot. So today, the presence of God is the most important thing in my life, and sometimes it's major and massive, and sometimes it's subtle and small. And I pray throughout the day, and I'm constantly talking to God because I want that relationship. It's, to me, I have been catapulted into the fourth dimension, and if that sounds weird, I get it. It is such a fun way to live. It is so cool being in God's world. It's like, I feel like I'm in this video game with God, and like I know God is doing all this stuff, and I'm like, I can't wait to see what you're going to do next. And then I'll pray and ask for guidance, and then there it is. And I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. Like all the time, all the time. Sometimes it's like God shoots lightning bolt down, and I'm like, whoa, you're amazing. And sometimes I'm like a little breeze, and I'm like, was that you, God? But like yesterday, I was like, just to make it like practical, because it sounds abstract, like just yesterday. And remember, I'm the statistician who needed proof, right? But now I'm getting proof all the time. I'm in the car. I have like 4 different big projects for work that I'm working on. And I work for myself. So I work for God. I'm an agent for God. Like I really am. God's my boss. And like, I don't say that as like a, that's the truth. That is just the truth. I meditate and I ask God, what do you want me to do today? I know God is my boss. And I literally ask God, what's the task at work today? My whole career, everything about me has been shifted in sobriety. You know, God, like, God's the father, I'm the daughter. God is my boss. I have a new employer. And it really does look like, so yesterday I was in Palm Springs with the family for Thanksgiving. And I drove back yesterday, and I parked my car outside Starbucks. And when I'm getting ready to park my car, I prayed, hey, God, what do you want me to work on today? Because I'm really excited about all these 4 things, and I could spend my energy today on any of the directions. But which one's a priority for you? Which one would you have me do first? And it's all of service, and it's, you know, it's all like, it all feels very like God-centered. Like I'm asking God, all of it came from meditation, everything I'm working on, and guidance I've gotten from God. So I don't know what I'm supposed to do, and I just over and over and over again give it up to God. And I'm like, what do you want me to work on today? And there's one project that has to do with sororities and colleges. So I get out of my car, ask God what to do, and I look over, and the woman walking in front of me has, like, Kappa, I don't know, I did not go to a sorority, like, Gamma, Kappa, whatever, Theta. She's wearing a sorority sweat hoodie, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I walk into Starbucks, and the guy in the corner has, like, UC San Diego. I'm like, okay. And then the person next to, like, behind me in line has, like, a college, like, hat on. I'm like, is it always like this? But, like, that's clearly one of the projects I'm working on, so I spent the day working on that project. You know, and then I just smile. It's like, I don't know, like, if that doesn't make sense to you guys or if it does, but, like, I'm constantly talking to God and asking for guidance. My third step prayer, my life is a big third step. Not because I want to look good in AA or give a fuck what anybody thinks about me. There's the swearing again. Because it's a better life. Because my experience, this was what I was going to say before. My experience, if this was my one-liner that I used to say, it doesn't matter if there is or there isn't a God. Like, at the end of my life, if, like, to me, personally, if I die and the joke's on me that there was no God, right? Hey, Kirsten, end of your life, you were a fool for believing in God. There isn't one. Like, there is no joke on me, because whether there is or there isn't is irrelevant to the fact that my life is fundamentally better when I have faith. That's what I got, that's what I got down on for myself, is I need proof of God. The proof is that my life today, in this moment, is better when I have faith than when I don't. That's all the proof that I need, is that my life is better when I have faith. And so I continue to do it. You know, it's not for anybody else. It's for me. It's so I keep trying to get out of my way. And so I moved to Bali June 2014. Because I believed it was God's will for me. I had an experience there, a profound God experience, and I believed it was God's will for me. And then I was there for 3 years. I know exactly what God was, I mean, I meditated. I'm pretty sure what the whole journey was about, a very God-centered. Although, I kind of got off the AA path for a minute and almost ended up drunk. I was totally bedeviled. And I did the steps again. You know, I got a little, but prayer meditation isn't the solution. It's not enough. I actually need to be working with other people and doing the steps myself. So then I moved back and I had another profound experience. It actually lasted a week. I didn't want this job that God gave me. And so for a week I had the full on chills and this knowing of what I am to do. And it's just terrifying. Like, I'm like, really, God, you think that I can do this? I don't think so. It was a really scary thing, but I'm really confident. Like, I have such a close relationship with God now. I know what God wants me to do. It's undeniable. I am too sober to ignore the God that flows through me. God's the great reality deep within. I can't deny it anymore. I can't pretend like it's not happening. I can't pretend like my boyfriend isn't a drug dealer with guns. I can't pretend that, like, that, you know, this trauma happened at work and, like, I'm, you know, I can't go take a Xanax. Like, I feel God and I go with it. Like, you know, the other way, it's like, there is no choice. It's not that I'm a victim of the feeling of God. It's, there just isn't a choice. This is the life. It's the God life. And God's like, leave Bali and go do this thing. Get a car, go to San Diego first, and then you're going on a road trip and you're doing this specific thing. And I'm like, ah, that's terrifying. You know, but I'm up for it. I'm up to be a child of God in God's world, and it's beautiful. And you know what's really funny is I will literally have a bit of an empath too, so I'm pretty sensitive. I don't know. I'm sure a lot of us are really energetically sensitive, right? But I will have a thought, and it's clearly Kirsten's thought because I'll feel like it sounds good. It's clever. Look at me. And I'll be like, I'll name my new project this. That's great. I'll look good. And then I'll have this other idea that comes from somewhere else that I don't really like as much. And my whole body, like, zings, like, God's, like, striking me. And I'm like, but I don't want that. I want this one. And then I'll think of the God one. My whole body does it again. And I'm like, it's like God is, like, telling me what to do. And then guess what? I say, F it, right? I'm in God. I'm doing God's thing. And I want to keep getting this data, you know, of living in God's world and exploring that. So I do it. Guess what? Guess what happens? Everyone freaking loves it. Guess why? Because it's not my idea, you know? And all of a sudden, everyone's like, vroom, you know? And it's like 30 million times more effective than the things that I try to do. Because God is using me to help his kids, just like he uses his kids to help me and has been, you know? Like, I feel like when I get guided to things, it's God is bringing me someone to love or someone to love me or someone to help or someone to help me. It's about, like, connecting and helping each other out. That's kind of usually what it's around. So I trust that. And so I'm here and it's fun. And so I just pray, like, I just pray for the courage and I pray for the strength. Like the big book always, like, things pop out. I'm like, where did that word come from? Where did that line come from? And that's not a surprise. Like, that happened over the years. You know, I'm 8 years in. But I just noticed, like, a year ago, the steps, something popped out of the steps. I'm like, man, they read those at every meeting. Yeah. It's embarrassing. When did they put this part in?
Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out.
I'm like, oh, you mean it's not just prayer and meditation? I need, like, to pray for your power to do your will? That's so cool. So I, like, get this hit. I go to meditate, and I'm like, all right, God, what do you got for me today? I got my pen and my paper. I go to meditate, and I, whoa, that's a good idea. Yeah, totally. I write it down. And then I'm like, well, how am I going to do that? God, please, 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 if this is your will for me, please give me the strength to and the persistence to follow through. And, like, things start, like, I'm getting this really fun momentum in my career. Because I'm working for God. Like, because I'm not doing what I want. I'm letting myself be guided. I'm taking the action that I feel guided to take. And people are into it. Because I am being used. And there's nothing more fun for me than to feel that I'm being used by God. Like, I was literally, when I first got to San Diego in August, I was in Encinitas. It was my second day here. And I was going to go to a meeting in Encinitas because it's right there. There's meetings everywhere. And I get this, like, hit, go to Pacific Beach, go to a meeting there. I'm like, that's weird. I was like, go to Pacific Beach, go to a meeting now. I'm like, but I wanted to do Encinitas Saturday night. So I went to the PB 2 p.m. Alano Club meeting. And this woman, they weren't going to have the meeting because no one was there to do the meeting. And I was like, well, I got the book on my phone. I'll read it, whatever. So me and two other people did the meeting, and this woman walks in 10 minutes late. Looked like, she looked physically like I looked when I was her age, you know, when I was 23 years old, a while ago. And, you know, I started sharing and I was like, oh, she's why I'm here. I just knew it. I felt it. I felt when she walked in, God wants me to help her. And so then I shared and she was crying while I shared. I had a coffee with her afterwards for an hour and a half. Now we're almost through step one together. You know, she's deep in the work now. It's like God keeps giving me the text messages. But could you imagine if you're trying to date someone and every time, like, you text them and then you turn your phone off for a week? You know, you just don't listen? Like, hey, God. relationship are you going to have? You know, or if you're on a treadmill and you're running and you're like, God, you want to get married? Or like to your partner, it's like, no, you take time for the special calls. Quick calls. Like for me, it's like God will get, like there's like lingo too. It's like quick ones. Like my quick third step prayer is make it obvious. Like your will for me. Make it obvious, all right? You know, we ask for an intuitive thought and over time, you know, sometimes it's funny. Sometimes I think I know God's will and I'm like I used to think if I felt like sparks with a dude, oh, his name must be God's will, right? It's God's, clearly it's God's will because I'm feeling it. No. No. I remember one time I prayed, I'm like, God, where's my boyfriend? And then I go to a meeting and I'm the speaker and this guy's like, oh, we have the same sobriety date. I was like, and you're cute. That's totally God's will. No, it's not exactly like that. It's so sometimes I get confused in God's will, but over the years I get a little more clear. And like I said, it's a little more undeniable and it's a really, really cool way to live where I'm in the fourth dimension and I'm aware of the presence of God throughout the day, not all day, every day, but a lot of the time throughout the day. And you better believe that I hit my knee, like I always told you in the beginning, I hit my knees in the bathroom before I spoke in this meeting. Doesn't matter what I'm wearing or what the bathroom floor looks like. I hit my knees in the bathroom and I say, God, please help remove my fear and help me remember it's not about me. And it's not about, I love you newcomers. It's not only about the newcomers. It's about the alcoholic who's still suffering. And sometimes that's the person with 35 years who's considering blowing their brains tonight. You know, I need to remember it's for the alcoholic who's still suffering. And sometimes that's me. And most of the time when it's me, I don't have the courage to speak up or call somebody. I just suck it up and stay home and don't talk to anybody, which is not helpful. So I got to pray for the alcoholic who is still suffering. And yeah, so if this is if you don't relate to me, I don't represent AA. I'm just a chick who drank a lot, who doesn't have to drink anymore, who like this one thing called AA worked, you know, for a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body like me. And so if you don't relate to me, that's fine. Go to another meeting and find somebody who looks maybe like, I'd say relatively sober, happy, whatever. If you want what they have, if they're giving a message and you're into it, ask them what they did and they should show you the 12 steps through this book. You know, it's the only thing that's worked for me. You know, and I tried vacations, yoga, like whatever. So this stuff works. And if you have a problem, I'll close on this. If you have a problem with the idea of a higher power, which is of your own conception, you don't even have to call it God. It's just saying words in your mind. Let's get real logical here. It's saying, please help me. It's just, please help me. It's three words in your mind. No one's going to know. Please help me not drink. Why are we so stubborn? Like, I won't say a word, something in my mind that no one will ever know, but I won't do it. Do it. Why not? Why not? Fuck it. Rebel against your stubbornness. Okay, thanks. Yeah.